Welcome to a Leader's Journey podcast. I'm your host, Joel Gunn, and today I have with me Jenny Lord. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to get to know you a little bit better.
Likewise.
You're CEO of Chosen.
Yes.
You started it up from scratch, right?
I did.
It's grown now, serving 2,000 people typically in a given year, and now moved nationwide, based here out of the San Antonio area.
Yes, sir.
Tell us a little bit about. Give us a little bit of your background, mom of four, and then we'll get into some fun stuff.
Sure. So I've been in this area for about 20 years now, and I have four teenagers. So we have a very busy household, just one husband, and I'm going to keep him around, I think. But four teens, and absolutely love what I do, and have been had at the helm of this organization for about 15 years now.
Yeah. Tell the audience a little bit about Chosen.
So Chosen helps children and families heal from trauma, primarily kids and families that have intersected with the child welfare system, foster families, adoptive families, grandparents who are raising grandchildren, and families that can be safely reunified. And we provide mental and behavioral health services via telehealth. And we've been doing that for about 8 years, which has allowed us to grow that national footprint. Hmm.
That's great. And how are you funded, just through private donations, or there? How's that?
Yeah, good question. So just a little bit of background of my story. The reason that I started the organization, my passion was really birthed about 30 years ago. I have a brother that was adopted out of foster care, and his journey took 4.5 years to complete his adoption. And so I really saw the inside of the child welfare system and how a system that is designed to protect children actually sometimes brings them harm. And so it was very grievous to me and really lit a fire inside of me to want to help bring about systemic change. And so I'm extremely passionate about what we do, and we're approaching the space differently and really prioritizing the health and well-being of not just the children, but also the families. Mm. So just a little bit of backstory on the organization.
What did you find was kind of some of the keys to the model that you've built that makes it different?
Yeah. So when I first started the organization, we were actually funding adoptions, and we did that for about 5 years and grew across the country serving families in that way. And several years into it, I learned that some families couldn't keep going. They were dissolving adoptions and putting kids back into the system because of the trauma that the kids had experienced. The way that trauma manifests oftentimes in a home is through behaviors, big behaviors, and that cause chaos and cause pain and heartache for the whole family. And so that really burdened me, and that my question was, who is helping these families heal from what their kids have experienced, but also who's helping them to keep going? So I led the organization through a missional shift. And when at the time, what I like to share is that my naivete, I think, has served our families and the organization well. I don't have a social work background. I don't have a government background. So my question wasn't, what will the government pay for? It was, what is best for children and families to help them heal and to keep going? And so from that question, we built a discipleship model, really. And we use evidence-based tools. That's a fancy way of saying we use tools that are backed by science, that have evidence that they're effective, but it's gospel-centered. And the approach is really to empower families with the tools that they need to keep going, not creating reliance on any one organization. Mm. And so that was really the driver for me to prioritize children belong in families, and our system tends to only look at the safety of the child. They're not even considering that the child was born into a family, that God's design is a child in a family, and so it's important that we don't look only at the child's needs, but the family's needs. And so that's how our approach is different. You asked about funding. Historically, when I started the organization, learned a whole lot real quickly about fundraising, and we were 100% philanthropy funded until 2020. And our big goal going into the year of a pandemic that we didn't predict was that we were going to diversify our revenue streams. And I stuck to that goal that year because I knew that if I didn't in the season of such unknowns, that we were going to be in the same position the next year, reliant on the woes and winds of the funder, and that's just not sustainable. So we diversified revenue streams, and about 40% of our income today is through earned revenue, through wow. contracts and different sources.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's I hear more and more nonprofits looking at that model mm-hmm. to where they can create some sort of revenue stream, and it's not easy, especially but you're thinking out of the box. You're not from that industry, as you said. You're not a social worker.
I'm also thinking long-term beyond me. I want the organization to outlive me. The mission and vision that we have for systemic transformation is extremely important, and there are a lot of hurting families who really need the services. And so creating that financial, not just sustainability, but financial resilience to for the long-term is really important to me as the leader.
How does someone become aware of your organization?
Great question. So about 90% of the families that come to us are through referral. They're through word of mouth from people like you who are like, wow, I learned today that somebody on my friend's staff is raising grandchildren unexpectedly, and her life just got turned upside down, and she doesn't know which direction is up or down. So she needs some additional support. So oftentimes through referral of friends and family, but also Child Protective Services, mm-hmm. judges, mental health providers, child placing agencies, and so forth.
Yeah. That's great. Just before the show, we were talking about some direction we might go. Do you have a story that really impacted your leadership style? Maybe you want to share that with the audience.
Sure. So a little background about me. I'm the oldest of four kids, the only girl. My mom was often single when I was growing up, so I was in charge a lot. In fact, in third grade, my favorite book was Little Miss Bossy. There was a reason for that, because I was getting in trouble for being bossy, right? So, you know, just by birth order alone, I kind of was in that leadership role and had several opportunities. And when I was about 25 years old, I took a spiritual gifts test. And in my test, leadership showed up, you know, right at the top of my spiritual gift. But I looked back at the questions and how it ranked me and where were their deficiencies. And everywhere I got deemed where it wasn't like the highest, you know, part of leadership was on delegation. And that was very eye-opening for me. You know, that was a long time ago, and we didn't have podcasts, and I hadn't probably read any leadership books at that point yet. And so I hadn't been trained as a leader. I had just been put in that role often in my life. So I didn't know about delegation, and that it was eye-opening. At the time, I was leading college-age youth in their journey of discipleship. And I was actually a leader of leaders. And the girls that were under me, they were in college as well, but they had small groups under them, accountability groups. And so the minister that had put me in charge of that, he just said basically, like, you have autonomy, figure it out. And so I was learning as I went. But when I took that test, I realized, okay, I can empower some of these young leaders around me with more responsibility than I'm currently giving them. It doesn't all have to fall on me. And, you know, I was the type of kid in middle and high school, like, you wanted me on the team for a group project because it was going to get done. Like, I was going to carry the weight of other people not doing their part. In fact, just get out of the way. Like, I want to make sure I get an A, you know? And so that type of mentality, while it got me by, it and obviously honed some skills, it was not the way of how a leader needs to really lead. And it was going to be an Achilles heel for me if I didn't learn that empowerment lesson. So that was eye-opening, and it's been an evolution, a journey mm-hmm. ever since.
Any tips or tricks you learned to how to delegate to people or empower them?
Yeah. You know, I've learned one of the biggest lessons that I've learned is really about empowering, giving autonomy around outcomes instead of just tasks. If you delegate task, then you're always in the position of telling somebody what is next. And then also you're giving them the sense of just working from a checklist. And I don't think that's an effective way to lead. And it, even though I don't have the style of a micromanager, it can put you in that position of they come back to you and say, okay, what next, right? And really, you want to empower somebody with a role and the outcome that you're looking for. And I am a visionary, and so I often can't see all of the details. In fact, usually can't, even when somebody's like, how do you want me to do that? And I'm like, I have no idea. Here's what I'm looking for the outcome to be. And so I think painting that picture and then moving out of the way to give people the autonomy. One lesson that I have learned, though, is not to not to take that approach of go figure it out. I think that old tendency for myself, one, I was that way when I was young, like I'm going to take initiative and go figure it out. And if I don't know how to do something, right? But I don't think that that's always effective. You need to be near to someone when you're empowering them to help coach and support them where they do have questions and maybe aren't wired to just go figure it out. So.
Mm-hmm. How do you decide when to be, to what level of involvement, right? Like, so do you hold their hand till they get it? How do you balance the being secluded in the ivory tower versus down in the trenches with the people? Is there some sort of kind of happy medium there that works for you, or where do you fall on that scale?
I'm always learning. And I'm definitely not in the trenches, the day-to-day at the front lines of our service array. But with those that I lead that are on our senior leadership team, especially if it's a new hire, you know, somebody taught me a long time ago, when you hire somebody new and you're still learning each other, you're still learning their capabilities, how they work, how they're wired, you're building trust, which you don't have right out of the gate, right? It's really important to stay really close to somebody. I'm going to be right here with you, and then I'm going to move side by side, and then there's going to be more distance over time as there's trust and confidence, right? And so I've definitely made that mistake of delegating authority or empowering too quickly and being disconnected, and then having to go back and correct that and own my mistakes of, you know, I wasn't the support that you needed early enough, right? And so I think it's a dance a little bit.
Accountability is a big word. How do you practically apply accountability in your organization?
Well, we run the organization off of Entrepreneurial Operating System, EOS, from the book Traction. And we implemented that almost 7 years ago. And if you know anything about EOS, there is a high degree of accountability, and there's really nowhere to hide. So the expectations are really clear around annual goals, ROCs, weekly action plans to keep us on track. So I think the system and the structure provide the accountability that's necessary. And what I've found is people really respond well to it. It's not like it's not a punitive thing. Mm-hmm. You can see the progress towards your goals. We track ROC completion across the organization, and that makes people feel good. And it also creates probably a little bit of positive peer pressure, because mm-hmm. you're going to report on it weekly and you know you got to get it done.
Mm. Yeah, I know several of my clients are on the EOS model as well, and found it a very productive tool.
You know, I think too, one of the things that I learned early on, especially because I'm not a micromanager, is the language that's helpful for me is, if let's say I delegate a project to you and I'm like, Joel, I need your help with this project. I can really see how beneficial this is going to be to our families. I don't have the time to really execute on it by myself. And then I say, let me know if you get stuck. And so if you come to me and you're like, all right, I put together this framework, but I'm kind of stuck in this area, then I know, like, okay, that's different than you not taking responsibility or ownership of a project that's been given to you, right? Using that stuck language is super helpful for me, because then I know, like, okay, I'm going to help coach you through figuring this out. Maybe it's supporting you together. Maybe it's just coaching, like, tell me how you think you should approach it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that helps people not feel like they're alone and accountable.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Yeah, it gives them a little bit of an out, right? Instead of coming and saying, I'm dropping the ball, or some of those negative mm-hmm. things that we put with it, hey, I'm stuck. Yeah. Jenny, you were probably had an obstacle or two along the way.
Just a few.
tell me about a time that you had to navigate an obstacle, and what were some of the things you were, as leaders, we hate to use the word fear, but because we're supposed to be strong and brave and all those things. But was there any fears associated with that? How'd you overcome that? How'd you help the team navigate?
I mean, I have lots of obstacles. One that comes to mind early on when we went through the missional shift to do what we're doing today. Actually, driving here this morning, I was thinking, wow, it's been almost 10 years since that shift started. Because it was 2014 when I had that moment of who is helping these families long term. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of the shift. And when we built the model, we had to test it out. Is this going to really work? We were going to start with a pilot because we were going to get it funded through a local foundation. And their question to us was, how are you going to measure change with the families so that we can demonstrate this model that we've created from, you know, it's a concept at this point, unproven. It wasn't there. We didn't have measurement tools. And so if you're going to continue that, then you've got to figure out, okay. So we went back to the drawing board, and my number two, who's been with me for 11 years, she was so mad with the question at first, you know, like, how do you measure discipleship? Well, it's really important that we figure that out. So that was one of the first obstacles, was just, how are we going to measure that change? And that question from the funder, it really made us better, because we had to go back to the drawing board and figure out that tool. And we implemented a clinically based tool that measures trauma symptoms in children, showing things like depression, anxiety, PTSD, and we ultimately see those numbers go down. But we also implemented a tool measuring parental stress, because parents who are really stressed, that they can actually, that can turn into abuse. It can turn into substance abuse for them, or just quality of life, right? And so we implemented those tools. So that was one obstacle. But the biggest obstacle around starting something new that's unproven is this really going to work? Mm-hmm. Is this really, Lord, are you in this? Is this going to work? And so for us, I think number one, faith is the foundation of our core values. And so relying on that faith, modeling the faith, reminding people that we'll have what we need when we need it, mm-hmm. And that the Lord will show us where to get the things that we don't have, right? And so I think faith was number one, but then just wise counsel. That's one of the greatest things that I've learned in my time at C12, was just that you cannot undervalue the counsel of godly people around you who have been in this game longer than you, whether that's business or programs specifically or just life, right? And so I think relying on that wise counsel, and then as those inevitable mistakes come, what do we learn from that? So I'll unpack that just a little bit. In the model, when we first created it, it was really designed to be a mentor model with volunteer mentors. And we piloted it with 10 families and learned a ton. And so one of the things that we learned very quickly was that our mentor families, who had been in the game a lot longer than our mentees that were coming to us, they actually needed the support just as much as the mentee families. And so that was super eye-opening and not expected. And then the other thing that we learned was that families were struggling with crisis levels that were way beyond what we had estimated, and that they really needed something beyond. They needed professional help. They didn't only need the volunteer support. They needed people who could address clinical needs that were way beyond the capacity of a volunteer mentor. So for us, I like to call it, I need a better word. Maybe you can help me with this. I used to call it postmortem. It's like, you know, you run an autopsy on a pilot of like, okay, what went well? What went wrong? What do we learn here? What could we massage and do better? But I think that analysis, especially when you're launching something, whether it's big or small, or it's an event or whatever it may be, but just taking the time with the team to get each other's input. And I know for me, I run fast, big vision, big picture oriented. So sometimes it's easy to overlook the smaller wins, or maybe that aren't even small to other team members, but giving people the space to share what went well and what would you change next time, I think is imperative to learning from those obstacles and hopefully avoiding the same types of barriers in the future.
What, when you were launching this new model, what were some of the thoughts going around in your head, the concerns, the it's easy to talk about the wins, but was there ever doubt? Was there, like, what'd you wrestle with?
Well, honestly, one of the biggest doubts and fears in the beginning was beyond, is this going to really work? Was just trying to communicate in the system of care. We had built something from scratch that was untested, unproven, and it was a different approach to the work. It was looking beyond the physical needs of the child. And so there was a lot of obstacles in the beginning because it was really disruptive the way that we were thinking about it. And people wanted to say, this is just how our brains work. You want to compare, right? Like, oh, you're like so-and-so, or your approach is like that. People are looking for something to compare it to so they can understand it quickly. And we didn't have something to compare it to. And so that in and of itself made it very difficult to launch. And so it felt like fits and starts in the beginning. We got the initial funding for a pilot. And then it took a long time to kind of catch the flywheel to see that, no, we really sought the Lord in this design and this is going to work. But getting people to see that an approach, not only was it needed, but that it was going to be effective. And you know, the proof is in the pudding, right? And so once people started seeing the impact and the results and the number of families that were staying together, it was like, huh, what are they doing over there? Mm-hmm. And particularly during the pandemic when the wheels were coming off of so many households. Mm.
You're a positive person. How do you stay that way? Like in your darkest day, your darkest moment, where do you go to recharge, or where do you find that positivity?
Well, daily quiet time in the morning is imperative for me. Just time in the Word, time with the Lord, reflection time. And it's not formulaic. It looks different in different seasons of life. But some time in the morning alone is really important to me. I said I have four teenagers. I actually had three kids in 26 months. And so I had a 2-year-old, a 1-year-old, and a newborn. And I was extremely sleep deprived. And my life was felt like a little bit of a roller coaster. My husband traveled all the time for work. And I had waxed and waned in my consistency and finding that quiet time in the morning. And when you get up 3 or 4 times in the night with kids, it's hard to get up before anybody else. But when my third daughter was born, she was about 2 months old, and I just had an incredible experience where I really realized, like, this is non-negotiable for me. If my kids are waking me up, that is not going to be a good start to the day. I've got to get up and have that time in the morning. So that's the first thing. And the second thing for me is just having safe colleagues, friends that understand the challenges of leading an organization, not to vent, but to encourage each other when it's hard. Mm-hmm. And it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everybody looks at leaders and go, man, I want to be them. But there's a cost of leadership.
100%.
Speaking of leadership, what do you think some of the biggest misconceptions about leadership?
Well, it's interesting what you just said. I think that that's one of them, is that leadership is fun and glamorous. And there are some fun times within leadership. And I've had some incredible opportunities to meet you know, different people around the country and be in special rooms. And I cherish those opportunities. But, you know, I'm sure you've met famous people too, or politicians, and they're just like you and me sitting here that need a drink of water, right? And so that is not that glamorous. It's just part of the job. But I think I remember there, I listened to this, it was probably about 10 years ago, I heard John Maxwell speaking. I love this story. He said he has so many young people come to him and say, I want to be a leader. Can you help me be a leader? And he looks at him and just says, why would you want to be a leader? It's really hard. And only the way that he can deliver that. But mm-hmm. it is hard, mm-hmm. and it requires a ton of sacrifice. And so while there are fun aspects to it, in fact, one of the most rewarding, it goes beyond fun. One of the most rewarding things is to see people on your team flourish in God's design, to see them elevated and their God-given design and talents be unleashed mm-hmm. For kingdom good is incredibly rewarding. Mm-hmm. And I don't take that lightly. But leadership comes with a lot of sacrifice.
How do you find or help people find where they flourish? What's your role in that, do you think?
Well, I think setting the tone of expectation within the culture, that's important to us. We have a woman on our staff who is incredibly gifted, and she had been with us for probably about 2 years and moved seats a couple of times. And part of the challenge with her is when you've got multiple gifts, it's like, how do we best deploy this? Like, we didn't have a cookie cutter that she fit in. We didn't have a role that was already designed. And so, you know, I just, in our last staff retreat, I used her as an example. I'm like, Bethany's on the bus. We're not sure that Bethany's in the right seat on the bus. It's really important to us that we find that. And we want to create open communication between supervisors and staff, that if you're discontent or you want to try something, we're pretty entrepreneurial. We're, you know, always doing new things and being innovative in the way that we're approaching families, designing training and so forth. So we like to give people opportunity that goes beyond just a job description. And I think being vocal about that in the culture, it's part of my responsibility, but then you have to have leadership around you that is reinforcing that with their people. And sometimes that's just the quarterly check-ins of how's it going? What's working really well for you? What do you hate about your role? You know, and not that we can always change those things, but we can work towards progress, right? Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. What are some of the most difficult decisions you've had to make?
They're always about people, right? Mm-hmm. I think people challenge, we're in the people business, and we have big hearts, and we want to see people thrive. And when they're not thriving, when it's not working well, making some of those decisions are difficult. And sometimes they're outside of your control, from cash flow issues or not having a seat that really fits how somebody's designed. And in that, there's a kindness to let somebody move on to where they actually can thrive. But mm-hmm. always people decisions are probably the toughest. Mm.
How do you navigate through those personally? Like, how do you process that?
Well, let's be honest. You know, that's probably when I might lose some sleep, is when you've got people challenges. But honestly, I've had some really incredible business coaching around navigating people challenges. I mentioned core values earlier. We have our core values, but beyond just our core values, we have behaviors that are associated with those, and it's the way that we expect people to show up. And those are not top-down driven. We're decided upon by the team. There's about three behaviors that are tied to each core value. So then the expectations are clear. And when you can point to something about that's on paper in an expectation versus pointing at you, Joel, like you're not meeting the mark like this. It takes some of the personalization out of when it's you're not navigating it. So I think the business coaching has been extremely helpful for me in navigating some of the organizational challenges.
What are you excited about? What's the future look like for Chosen?
Well, that is a great question that I wasn't expecting. I don't know if I'm prepared to say. I'll tell you, I'm really excited about a new program that we have that has just launched last year. It's called Adea, and Adea stands for, the meaning of Adea is God's jewels. Mm. It is for youth who are at greatest risk of aging out of foster care without relational permanency. What does that mean? I'm just use some jargon. It's the 14 to 17 year old who has bounced around foster care, who doesn't have a home necessarily. They might be sleeping in a hotel. They might be sleeping in a CPS office, Child Protective Services office. And this is a problem across our country. And frankly, it's abhorrent because these youth are, what they are experiencing is the equivalent of POWs. And I don't say that lightly, but there is evidence that shows that PTSD levels for kids in foster care that move like this are 2 to 3 times that of prisoners of war.
Wow.
And for these youth, they are literally moving often night to night. So wake up today, not sure where they're sleeping tonight. They don't have any possessions because they have no way to keep those. Mm-hmm. And a different caseworker may pick them up after school, take them to somebody's house after dinner, and they're going to sleep in a bed and then wake up the next morning and a different caseworker is going to pick them up. They don't know where they're going. And you talk about devastating on the psyche and the soul. Mm. These youth, we want them to know that they are seen. They are valued. They are treasured. They are made in the image of God. Mm. And we want them to know they have worth. And so we have a program that's going specifically to these youth and working with them. We started it here in San Antonio. We just launched another, the same program in Tennessee. And actually Tennessee asked us to do this program. We're talking with some other states about it as well. It's a huge need. It's messy. This work is messy and hard and painful, but these youth are so worth it. We have a young lady who, she's in this program here in San Antonio, and we started working with her. She'd been in care for 2 years. She's 14 years old. She had had multiple psychiatric hospital stays. I read her file. Her could not go home to either parent or to her grandparents. There was abuse in both cases. So it means that she's legally adoptable. She doesn't have a stable parent in her life. She had been in 5 placements, and a woman from our staff, QLS, started meeting with her. And after the first time she met with her in a hotel, the young lady ran away the next day. Mm. This is common, and this is what we call elopement. She ran away. That's how some of these youth end up getting trafficked, is because there's predators waiting for these youth in particular to promise them a different way of life, right? But Cuella kept showing up at the hotel, and the young lady came back to the hotel, and she ended up going to a residential center, and Cuella followed her to the center and has been meeting with her on a weekly basis. And just here over the holidays, she gave Cuella a stuffed animal that she had won. She's 14. I just think this is so precious. She had won it in an art contest, and she said, I know this is ghetto, but it's all I've got to give you. And she gave her a stuffed animal that she had won for her own art skills with a note that said, you saved my life. Mm. She said, I think without you, I would be dead or in jail.
Wow.
So, I mean, you just can't beat that. Mm-hmm. These kids are worth it.
Yeah. So most of us probably in America just go about our day trying to figure out how to do what we do. If somebody's listening to this this podcast, what's our role? What can we do, if anything, if we're prompted to do something?
Yeah, thanks for the question. You know, as believers, if you're a believer, we're called to care for the vulnerable. And that doesn't mean that you have to be a foster parent. It doesn't mean that you have to adopt kids. But we have a role and responsibility to care for these kids. And there's about 400,000 kids in foster care in the U.S. And we have more churches on our street corners than 400,000 in the U.S. So this is solvable. There's 100,000 kids that are eligible for adoption. This is solvable. And if you're not called to one of those things, you can support organizations like ours, organizations like they're everywhere in our community that are caring for vulnerable kids. You can be part of the solution.
Hmm. Where would somebody go to find that information? Like, just Google it or talk to friends or?
Well, if you're here, if you're listening and you're curious about our organization, our website is chosen.care. No.com, just chosen.care. I like to say we're not the chosen. We had the name first, but we are happy to
the TV show going into its fourth season.
But we're happy to share the name, and if you Google needs of foster care in my community, wherever you're listening from, mm-hmm. You're gonna find a pathway pretty quick.
That's great. Last question. What are your thoughts about the young leaders? What do you think they're going to face? What are your concerns or excitements for the next generation of leaders?
Well, I'm raising some, right? And so I love how curious they are. I love that they are not being spoon-fed religion, maybe. They're questioning things, and I think that's actually positive. Mm-hmm. I think they're those youth that I'm around who have true faith, it's authentic faith because it's fought for. Mm. Is they're fighting for truth in an age of a lot of mistruth, right? And they're fighting for truth in an age where they're completely saturated by a ton of noise. So it's hard to distill what is truth. So in that regard, I think we're raising up an incredible generation of people who want truth and are seeking truth. And I'm less concerned maybe than some in that regard. I think we're true faith is bubbling up from the next generation. One of my concerns as a leader is just longevity in roles. And to be honest, because I see so many even younger than my kids, I mean, older than my kids, 20s and 30s, just moving so quickly in a role, and there's a lot of transient nature in careers, and that is inherently challenging for leaders. But I also wonder what is the impact on people in terms of commitment, loyalty, persistence, and if your eyes are always open on the next opportunity, but you're not willing to like dig in where you are, I think that can breed some character challenges.
Thinking about the that last statement, character challenges, how do you have some younger leaders in your organization, or how do you expect that you're going to bring them into your organization if they're been jumping jobs? Like, right, you're looking at their resumes and you're going, wow, this young person, maybe they're 30 years old and they've had 10 jobs already. How do you accommodate that in your structure? If you have any examples, or how might you, because it's probably going to be a reality soon if it's not already.
It's a reality. In this, especially in the nature of the work that we do, it's hard and the burnout is real. Secondary trauma is real. When you're carrying heavy stories and absorbing some of that. And in social services, we're competitive for our sector, but it's just different in terms of financial benefits, right? So there's always going to be some challenges, I think, that are inherent just in what we do. But yeah, I think the best thing that we can do as leaders is ensure that we have a strong culture, that we're painting the vision for what that is, that we're reinforcing that vision, that we're giving people something bigger than themselves to live into, mm-hmm. and to be a part of, mm-hmm. and reward them when and as we can, and create a missional alignment for them personally, making sure that they know that their contribution to the larger mission and overall impact really matters. That's the best that we can do to hopefully retain folks. But we want people to be where God has designed for them to be. And so if they're with us for a short time and moving on, then we're going to celebrate that. Sometimes we grieve too, but we're going to hopefully maintain that relationship long term. And in our space, it is small, so we're all connected.
That's great. Well, Janie, it's been great having you on the show. Do you have any final thoughts you want to share?
Well, I've just really enjoyed the conversation today. Thanks for allowing me to share.
That's been my honor and privilege to have you.